Rob?
Sure. So, if you have a set of materials where the regular intended use is to have these things operate at temperatures, elevated temperatures, and you're going to consume it by inhalation, you need to do your fit for purpose analytical approach would be looking at what is delivered at those temperatures and what is potentially delivered. And if you do not, you're not really suitable for looking at the contaminant. So there can be some reference materials. We propose one with the heat and headspace to take a lot of the variables associated with the devices away. Mm-hmm. But we also need to look at what's the device, and that's almost a separate thing. But if you had a standard reference material, you could put it in different devices and then be able to compare device A to device B to device C. But unless you have
at the increased elevation of yes. temperature. Because yes. you can't always assume that a consumer will always follow the recommended practices for that particular device.
But a government agency could regulate that none of these devices could heat the product up above 220 Celsius.
Correct.
Or something like that. If we find a temperature, they could that could easily be a regulation, as could be ruling out products that we know are dangerous, like vitamin E acetate and these other ones you mentioned associated with popcorn lung. But we need to also have a screening to identify those, and that's what we're trying to do. But and that would be reproducible in other labs as well, as long as they have the headspace system.
Yeah. Another variable to add to the mix is these things typically use a heated wire. Those heated wires would make boil off the metal to get thinner, which makes the heat go up and makes you run the same current.
Yeah, and even worse than that, even if the liquid is in contact with the metal, depending on how much as the liquid levels change, the overall heat capacity and what temperature you get to is slightly different. So yeah, it's a difficult challenge, but doing nothing hasn't worked.
Absolutely, yeah.
The ceramic ones that you get the carryover issues too, right? Like it's a messy puzzle to tackle.
I was going to say, what's the rule of pH in the concentrate? Like when it's sitting on a metal foil for an extended period of time, and then it sits in a hot car for a week, and you know, then somebody takes a hit and says it feels very different physically than
and not.
And I know that's an anecdotal statement, but.
But even to go beyond that, if you heat it up once, and as we've shown, only for 5 minutes, you can get some of these degradation products present. When you use it again the next time, you produce more of those and degrading those as well, right? So, but I think if we don't, so forget about the challenge of what it is. If you don't have AOAC come in and have a group thinking about the best way to do this, it's going to be worse than if you do. So, Michael.
Excellent. Question for you. In your work, I was trying to remember, did you find any plasticizers in your analysis?
We weren't specifically looking for plasticizers. So we did too. We did look at the higher temperature, and we saw a whole sea of things, including not only benzene, but PAHs as well that would be generated, as you would expect with heat. Once you start forming aromatic rings, it's a thing. But we weren't specifically looking for those. But you could. But the question is, are they specifically more dangerous than other things are being
used? Yeah, I mean,
we've seen xylenes come out when people put hot concentrates into plastic cups just to submit for sampling.
Mm-hmm.
They had a leach from that.
Xylenes are another one we see.
The point being is the chemistry and the toxicology and the carcinogenicity of those plasticizers are already known. So you can look at those. That might be one of the markers, and particularly in your comments about the heating aspects of it, and Mike has brought up that, and also Catherine's work and FCC's work on CDC has reported out about associating vitamin E acetate with the health effects. How much does that have to do with these temperature issues? Because I'm sitting there wondering, okay, is it really vitamin E acetate? Is it breakdown products? Or is it something else that's extracted out at higher temperatures?
My feeling is it's the breakdown products. But what we don't understand is what temperature those people were using those products at. And even though there's been thousands of people getting sick, there's probably tens of thousands of people using similar products. They sell a lot of these products. And it's an equally important question, why didn't the other people get sick? Maybe they were using it at a lower temperature. And that's just broad speculation, but we need to start figuring those things out for both sides, right? The best way to answer scientific problems is just circle it from every possible angle, including why didn't these other kids get sick? They're using the same thing.
So to get back to your plasticizer's point, there's some, like the BSS, the British Standards Institute, and AFNOR, it's the French standards body, for, like, they have standards on HIMS, so nicotine delivery systems. And they do talk about, you know, there's parts of those that talk about, you know, look for these polymers or monomers or ligands or whatever, if your product uses these types of materials. And so leachables are a component of those standards, as are flavoring additives and metals and what have you. So there's some, you know, our, if it wasn't mentioned earlier, like Caresta, there's a lot of work, Caresta, with regards to like vaping methods, just different like smoking topographies, right? Yeah. So like, is it a long draw? Is it like, what's a tough regime and all of that, right? So there's, it's complicated. And,
so e-cigarettes are not new. Somebody made mention about not reinventing the wheel. Are there metrics for how much nicotine is delivered in a particular e-cigarette and what those metrics are based on?
Yeah, those standards speak to maximum nicotine. I don't know if they speak specifically to maximum nicotine concentration, but I feel like some of them do. It's been a while since I've reviewed them, but in
the vapor base.
I know they're talking about the liquids.
They're talking about the liquids.
Yeah,
okay.
but they do have an element of those standards is about the vapor. So I think AFNOR, they've broken their standard into the device,
mm-hmm.
the liquid, and the vapor. So three elements. Yeah.
And I think the missing piece there with those is you can have methods to look at the devices, and they've done a great job of that. You can look at the liquids, and that's another thing, but what happens to the liquids at the temperature?
That's what there's an emissions component there too.
But they're using the devices, as I understand it. They're not looking at it independently. So there's that issue. And it's very complicated. You saw the soup that we produced.
Yep.
And with that soup, how do you to figure out what the toxicity, not only of the individual components, but it's the summation of things. Because they can all have, you know, you're being attacked by a whole army of nasties. So that's hard. And that's why we relied on residual solvent just to screen things out, because then we didn't have to reinvent the wheel. The USP people have done a fantastic job of that. So let's use that just to throw in a handful of them to start with, right? So,
if you look at the number of CDC publications, particularly on heavy metals, they can calculate mass per puff. Yeah, and they do that. And with a specialized smoking machine, I mean, whenever they do these studies, they always talk about mass of the element per puff, and it's a fairly simple calculation, but you've got to know. I mean, the machines are fairly sophisticated, so you have to know that there's no contamination issues, and it's a clean system. But I think that's critical to know how much of the contaminant you're getting every time you take a puff of one of these devices.
Despite fantastic work by a lot of good people, 64 people recently have died from using this. For one ingredient. We need to find approaches so that we don't have another blip of 64 people and more die. And so the existing approaches, they're not working, so we need a new approach.
Hey.
Just a question. So in terms of e-cigarettes, when they first came on market, was there a regulatory approval process where there was a data package that needed to be submitted, and all of the, just like food additives and all of the compounds identified and all that kind of analysis done?
You know, all I could say, and I know of several FDA folks here who may be able to answer this.
So certainly the FDA, the deeming regulations, do require FDA deeming regulations, that regulates e-cigarettes as well along with cigars, has the requirements for making products.
So that the manufacturer would have had to spend all that data in
terms
of...
You'd be moving forward.
My point would be that there's a lot of information then in terms of what are the common volatile compounds that would be found in these types of products. And so, you know, you're not completely reinventing the wheel in terms of trying to understand what's going on.
Yeah.
It's more what's the novel chemical that what's the chemical that's different in a some of these vape products versus an e-cigarette.
So you need to put it in context with the history. And the history was those products came online to help people stop smoking as a way to as a,
no, so that's not my point. My point was that there is a lot known about the toxicology.
Yeah, but with that, when those products came on, the comparison was cigarette smoking kills you, this helps you get off of it. So they were not looking at it the same way that it would become a consumer product. And then it became
but again, I'm saying the toxicologists would have looked at it from the health viewpoint in terms of what are possible damages to the lung.
Well, I think you're getting vitamin E acetate introduced in a lightly to poorly regulated environment, right? Where your point is tobacco coming through the FDA, those have been screened, and there's a limited suite of items that you can add, and those are other stuff.
And I would assume that
so the glycerol, propylene, glycol were the initial additives. And those things didn't seem to cause at least a rash of issues, but they were very bland to use. So then they started adding flavors, and people liked it. Right? So, and then that became a popular product in its own. But the original thing when the screening of why it was okay, this will stop you from killing yourself.
But also, I would assume that again, you know, knowing FDA and you know submission of data, that they would have a standardized protocol in terms of the tests that you would do, and you know how you generate data. So,
and I appreciate your point, Henry. I'm just wondering of whether there would be whether that would fall into pre-market approval, and whether that material would need to be evaluated before going to market. And I don't know.
So the question you're asking is something compliance somewhat. Folks would have to answer. We're all lab guys.
Yeah, I mean, we're not from, so I don't want to speak for Center for Tobacco Products. I mean, first, their jurisdiction is limited to tobacco-derived products, so they have the issue of identifying the source of the nicotine that goes into those e-cigarettes to even have jurisdiction over that. But my understanding is, yes, they do have the Deeming Act did cover the e-cigarettes, but the ones they reviewed were integrated products. So nobody saw these products being broken into their components and people mixing up their own liquids to put in cartridges.
Yeah,
so the products that were sort of reviewed were very well defined, integrated, never meant to be taken apart, and you mix your own fluid. And yes, the initial fillers, the glycols and so forth, were seen as inert fillers. And I do agree, I think in the light of what's happened, there's I think new risks that are not perceived that may require additional testing. But yes, so they are the tobacco Center for Tobacco Products does follow a similar regulatory approach as drugs. So there is some pre-market review and approval as also some post-market monitoring.
Just to add to that, so in the tobacco industry today there are methods for measuring all the major ingredients, excipients, nicotine, PG glycerin, ethanol, and any flavorings in formulation. But there are also different methods to collect aerosol, depending upon whether it's a gaseous phase component or a particulate phase component, to measure these in the aerosol as well. So like a few years back, there was formaldehyde issue in baking products, that's a gaseous component, and there are collection protocols for that as well. So those standardized methods do exist in the industry, the tobacco industry, for nicotine-based vape products.
And I think the reporting requirements, something like 80 or 90 substances are required to be reported.
So my point actually is that you seem not denying that or affirming that there's a role for AOC in this, that there is a role for AOC to bring together some of the people who are, been involved in the past in terms of all the data development in terms of approved e-cigarettes and kind of combine it with all the new information.
Within the CASP, certainly is.
Yeah.
I totally agree with Henry. In fact, the similar discussions might be happening at Society of Toxicology, I would imagine, but they might be clueless about what, how to characterize the components. There's a lot of talent here, but here about the chemical analysis, but a lot of talent there about the toxicological interpretation. So I think that consideration is really important in any conversations, I think.
I would agree. I would say, however, the best approach that we could take is to make sure, as Henry pointed out, is there are experts and processes that have already been used to evaluate a particular matrix, in this case, e-cigarettes, and making sure that we use the best available resources. And by resources, I mean capturing the expertise from, say, the FDA, the vaping industry, the research that has already begun both by FDA and other laboratories to make sure that you aren't redoing something that is already available, and two, you're making sure that you get the best of everyone.
One of the missing points here is that we have a residual solvent test for derivative products from cannabis and other things that could be used in a vaping product. And as I pointed out here, we could have that pass the allowed limit for hexane. But when you use it in a device, that hexane is rapidly converted over to benzene. So is that really a fit for purpose test if we know that the thing that passed is going to fail when used as intended? So this is, makes this a different category of materials that we have to just think about a little differently.
Yeah. Right. Oliver, kind of getting back to your comment about the toxicologist, I'm sitting there thinking, okay, we can tell you what's in there and how much. They can tell you the significance. Who does that on a regular basis? It's your risk analyst. I'm thinking if we're going to look at maybe interacting with the toxicologist societies, we ought to include the Society of Risk Analysis or some similar group in this process.
Very right. Yeah. You know, modeling, because this is not one ingredient, this is many of them.
Yeah. And as was pointed out, we don't know what the toxic elements really are and what the toxic levels are.
Yeah.
We know
yeah.
some of them, but we don't know all of them. Yeah. And your point about the development of the vaping instruments at the beginning, they were originally designed to really be short-term use for people to get off of cigarettes. Now, we've got something that was originally designed to be used maybe 2 or 3 months, now being used for years. So there's a lot of other aspects.
Well, that begs the question, in the current sort of regulatory environment, who's going to identify the next vitamin E problem? This will die down eventually. I mean, same with heavy metals. But there'll be something out there, you know, the current state-based regulations, who is out there to identify this?
And that's why we have putting forward an ASTM method to screen ingredients, just to identify the next. And I will tell you right now, my bet, Phytol would have been if we didn't put information in the board.
Comment though, you could miss out on materials that have cellular interactions that cause toxicity, right? But you know, they don't have to be pyrolysis products necessarily.
Yeah. And these are oxidations and rearrangements. And if you think about, when you put enough energy into a system, what things end up being produced? Well, the most stable ones, yeah? Aromatics, in other words. These are the things that are thermally stable. So you're right. We got to look at those types of things. And we found that we had one mixture, a flavoring component that, yeah, it seemed to pass. Another one with a different flavor produced benzene. And it's just what's in there and how it's not just what's in there, it's not the sum of the parts. These things, when they get into an activation state of flight, become reactive and can produce a range of different compounds, some of which the more stable ones happen to be dangerous.
I was
caution a little bit that not to be single-mindedly focused on a single ingredient. Just to give you an example from the food industry. You talked about benzene. In the food industry, there was, some of you know that there was a problem about benzene in foods a few years ago. And the source of the benzene was the interaction between benzoate, sodium benzoate as a preservative, ascorbic acid, and a heavy metal under certain circumstances. So you had to have the three ingredients at least come together under the right circumstances in order to produce benzene. So, you know, as we're going through and developing, looking at protocols, you got to keep in mind that these are going to be complex systems, and whatever you're going to use, whatever you're going to develop, has to be applicable to a complex system.
Yeah, and that's why we recommended testing formulations as well as ingredients.
My ears picked up, I think it was in your presentation where you did targeted and non-targeted analyses, and immediately caught my attention, because that's something that you always have to stay ahead of, either whether it's intended, an intended adulterant, or it's a consequence of interactions that nobody could have.
Is the non-targeted working group committee still up and running?
There is. The focus from the food authenticity side of it was, you know, in a sense, the same type of idea where you have no, you're not looking for anything in particular, you're looking for a change in a profile. It can apply to foods or other commodities, liquids. But yes, it's just a matter of where your focus was. Thank you very much. This was a terrific conversation. I really value it. And particularly for staying longer. I'd like to thank all the speakers. One more time.